Today is Monday, September the 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. A growing number of Republican state leaders are vowing to mount legal challenges against President Joe Biden's COVID-19 vaccine mandate.
I propose requirement for COVID vaccines, and the governor of that state calls it, quote, a tyrannical type move. This is the worst kind of politics.
And hundreds of world leaders are expected to return to the United Nations for their annual meetings, the first such gathering in New York since the coronavirus pandemic. In Lebanon, the government has raised gasoline prices by 66% in response to the energy crisis. Meanwhile, Iranian-backed militia Hezbollah says that it will continue to import fuel into the country, a move that could provoke U.S. sanctions.
I do strongly believe that the coming days will witness more Iranian fuel coming into Lebanon, but it will be dedicated to the areas where Hezbollah is in full control.
And a new study on work-related causes of death finds that long working hours are the biggest occupational risk factor. We have those stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, New York will see one of its first large gatherings since the coronavirus pandemic, when more than 100 world leaders are expected to return to the United Nations for their annual meetings. VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir reports.
Some 125 leaders are expected in New York, where officials will take on pressing issues. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
Our world is heading towards a new abnormal, more chaotic, more insecure, more dangerous for everyone. We are moving in the wrong direction, and we are at a pivotal moment.
The week will begin with talks on climate action. Guterres and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson will meet with a few dozen other leaders. Their goal is to encourage more ambitious commitments to slow global warming and fund adaptation and mitigation efforts ahead of a key climate conference 6 weeks from now in Scotland. Again, UN Chief Antonio Guterres.
We really are out of time. We must act now to prevent further irreversible damage.
Halting the COVID-19 pandemic through global vaccination is the other urgent priority. The World Health Organization has set mid-2022 as its target for 70% of the world's population to be vaccinated. But poorer countries are not on track to reach this. On Wednesday, U.S. President Joe Biden will convene a virtual meeting on ways to curb the spread of the virus. Linda Thomas-Greenfield is the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations.
President Biden is committed to leading in concert with our allies and partners across the globe to stop the COVID-19 pandemic. We are building a coalition of governments, businesses, international institutions, and civil society to expand vaccine production, accelerate access to vaccines and life-saving treatment, and strengthen health systems around the globe.
But overshadowing these twin global crises is the latest geopolitical one, Afghanistan. Richard Gowan is the UN Director for International Crisis Group.
Afghanistan represents an enormous humanitarian challenge for the United Nations. And it's going to be UN agencies who are responsible for keeping Afghans alive during a period of hunger and political chaos.
G20 ministers meet Wednesday to discuss developments in Afghanistan. World leaders are also expected to address the issue during one-on-one talks. The Taliban's takeover is likely to figure prominently in Western leaders' speeches during the general debate, especially on the need to protect progress made on the rights of women and girls. Richard Gowan.
There's not very much the General Assembly can do to force the Taliban to protect those rights.
Starting Tuesday, leaders will address the General Assembly. One of the most anticipated statements will be from President Biden, who will address the General Assembly for the first time. U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield.
President Biden will speak to our top priorities, ending the COVID-19 pandemic, combating climate crisis, and defending human rights, democracy, and the international rules-based order. All three are challenges that stretch across borders. They involve every single country on Earth.
With only a week to cover many pressing issues, leaders will have little time to enjoy New York City, which has begun to reopen its museums, restaurants, and Broadway theaters. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
A growing number of Republicans, including state governors, have vowed to mount legal challenges against President Joe Biden's sweeping measures to compel workers and federal employees to get vaccinated against COVID-19. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widakuswara has the story.
Vaccine disinformation, including American rapper Nicki Minaj's erroneous viral tweet alleging coronavirus vaccination causes impotence, and Republican governors opposing President Joe Biden's vaccine mandates. These are just some of the challenges faced by the administration in trying to get more Americans vaccinated.
I proposed a requirement for COVID vaccines, and the governor of that state calls it, quote, a tyrannical type move. A tyrannical type move? This is the worst kind of politics, because it's putting the lives of citizens of their states, especially children, at risk. And I refuse to give in to it.
On Thursday, Biden slammed Republican governors fighting the mandate he announced last week to require vaccines for federal staff and contractors, healthcare personnel, and employees of businesses with 100 or more workers. More than a dozen states have enacted laws prohibiting mandatory COVID-19 vaccinations or even requirements for proof of vaccination. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis.
When you have a president like Biden issuing unconstitutional edicts against the American people, we have a responsibility to stand up for the Constitution and to fight back, and we are doing that in the state of Florida.
Even though the vaccine is free and readily available, only 55% of Americans are fully vaccinated. The administration hopes the Biden vaccine mandate will boost that number. The move is supported by 60% of Americans, according to a recent Axios Ipsos poll. Chris Jackson is head of polling at Ipsos.
That majority support hides very deep partisan divisions where over 80% of Democrats support the mandate, over 60% of independents support it, but only about 30% of Republicans support this new requirement, reflecting the continuing division on issues of COVID in the country.
COVID-related mandates have jeopardized political futures. Democratic California Governor Gavin Newsom faced a recall election this week, launched to protest his pandemic approach.
We said yes to science. We said yes to vaccines. We said yes to ending this pandemic.
The governor kept his job by a wide margin, but only after top Democrats, including Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris, visited California to boost his campaign. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
And France has recalled its ambassador to the United States in an unprecedented show of anger after the U.S., Australia, and Britain shunned France in creating a new Indo-Pacific security arrangement. It was the first time ever France has recalled its ambassador to the U.S., according to French Foreign Ministry. Paris also recalled its envoy to Australia, a sign of the widening rift that has developed over Indo-Pacific security. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn has more.
It's being described as a crisis in relations between the two longtime allies. The French foreign minister says never before has France recalled its U.S. ambassador, but says it's justified by the seriousness of Australia pulling out of a conventional submarine deal with France and switching to U.S. nuclear power technology. The Biden administration's been in contact with France, hoping the three countries can resolve the dispute spurred by the announcement of a U.S., U.K., and Australia security pact for the Indo-Pacific. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
And Australia is defending its decision to join a tripartite alliance with the United States and Britain, despite an angry reaction from France. From Sydney, Phil Massa has more.
Australia said Sunday it regrets France's decision to immediately recall its ambassadors to Canberra and Washington in response to a new deal that will make Australia only the seventh country to have nuclear-powered submarines. Australia scrapped a multi-billion dollar defence contract with France after joining the new AUKUS alliance with the US and Britain. It will instead build a new fleet of nuclear-powered submarines with help from the US and the UK. The pact is widely seen as an effort to counter China's influence in the contested South China Sea. Australia wasn't sure the attack-class diesel-powered submarines it ordered from France were up to the job. Prime Minister Scott Morrison said it would have been negligent to go ahead with the deal, against advice from Australia's intelligence agencies and its military. Australia's new submarine fleet isn't expected to be in service for decades, and it could lease or buy vessels from the United States or Britain in the meantime. Prime Minister Scott Morrison said the alliance would boost regional security.
This is seen as a positive move that contributes to peace and stability. All countries will invest in their own defence capabilities. Indeed, China does in theirs. And as we know, they've invested heavily in those capabilities.
Australian Defence Minister Peter Dutton Sunday defended Canberra's handling of the multi-billion dollar submarine contract with France, describing his government as upfront, open and honest in its dealings with Paris. France doesn't agree. French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian.
C'est vraiment en bon français, un coup dans le dos.
It really is a stab in the back. We built a relationship of trust with Australia, and this trust was betrayed.
The animosity could have wider implications. France said it would be unable to trust Australia in talks on forging a free trade agreement with the European Union, although EU officials have insisted negotiations will continue. Hervé Lemayeux is the Director of Research at the Lowy Institute, an independent think tank based in Sydney. He says France's response to the AUKUS alliance was unexpected, but he's urging French President Emmanuel Macron not to overreact.
It's quite unprecedented for France or any country to recall two ambassadors simultaneously from two different countries. France has to be careful not to overplay its hand. Their anger is legitimate and understandable, but mustn't be allowed to take control of their foreign policy. It's not clear, for example, that Macron speaks for all of Europe, given the silence from other EU capitals.
Lemieux says that China's military ambitions in the Indo-Pacific region could also face a greater challenge from the new AUKUS alliance.
The Chinese will read it as an escalatory act. There's no question it will escalate great power competition. And now the question is, does it create more stability or less stability? And that will be a key question for other countries in the Indo-Pacific.
China has accused the new alliance partners of having a Cold War mentality. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. The Lebanese government said on Sunday that it was raising gasoline prices by 66% by reducing fuel subsidies as it seeks to ease the energy crisis that has crippled the country's economy. Meanwhile, four convoys carrying fuel entered Lebanon under the supervision of the Iranian-backed militia group Hezbollah. The fuel was channeled through Syria in an effort to avoid U.S. sanctions. Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mikati said that the move undertaken by Hezbollah undermines the country's sovereignty. Reporter George Eid has more from Beirut.
Iranian-backed militia group Hezbollah has started bringing Iranian fuel into Lebanon via Syria. The Shiite Muslim group claims that the fuel that it is bringing into the country will help ease a crippling energy crisis. However, local media in Lebanon said that the amount of Iranian fuel brought into the country by Hezbollah will barely cover 10% of Lebanon's monthly need of fuel. Hezbollah said that the ship carrying the fuel docked in Syria after being warned that going to Lebanon could risk sanctions. Washington had previously made it clear that U.S. sanctions on Iranian oil sale remain in place. Senior Lebanese economic analyst Jesitrat Kostoun says that even though it is done through Syria, importing Iranian fuel still carries the risk of sanctions with it.
The first and the most important message that we get to understand from the arrival of the Iranian diesel to the Lebanese territories is that Hezbollah thus control the state of Lebanon. Today, the Lebanese state and the newly formed Lebanese government has lost credibility. What is really unfortunate is to see that Lebanese institutions and individuals are under the threat of U.S. sanctions just for some little quantities of Iranian diesel. I do strongly believe that the coming days will witness more Iranian fuel coming into Lebanon, but it will be dedicated to the areas where Hezbollah is in full control. So jeopardizing the whole of Lebanon just for the community of Hezbollah. With the shortage of dollars and sanctioned Iran, the Islamic State has found a new way to fund Hezbollah through sending diesel and gasoline that would be sold in Lebanese lira, exchanged in the Lebanese territories into U.S. dollars, and then sent back to Iran.
Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mikati commented on the import of Iranian fuel by Hezbollah, and he told CNN he was sad because this undermined the sovereignty of Lebanon, and he explained that attempts are being made to solve this issue calmly. He also added that Lebanon does not have enough funds to subsidize fuel or any other product at the moment. Critics, on the other hand, have claimed that Lebanon's struggle is due to a proxy war between the U.S. and Iran. Jad Saman, a local journalist and analyst, explains that many do not trust this government because it represents Iranian-backed Hezbollah in a way or another.
This government is, the lion's share in it goes to Hezbollah and to the son-in-law of the Lebanese president, a Christian ally, a Christian subservient of Hezbollah. All of this government is subservient to the same political formations, the same political parties who led us into this disaster. So how could you see any salvation coming out of this government? I don't know. We're paying the price for this ongoing war between the West, mainly when I say the West, the spearheaded by the U.S., and Iran. So why don't you find a solution, guys, between you and Iran and stop? Why don't you find a solution between you and Iran and stop making those populations pay the price in a proxy, in an endless proxy wars between you and Iran?
Hezbollah's leader Hassan Nasrallah has vowed that more Iranian fuel will enter the country. The militia has already announced that it will distribute some of the shipment and will sell the remaining part at less than half of the market price. The U.S. embassy, that had on many occasions commented on the attempts to import Iranian fuel, did not comment on the last move. This is George Aid reporting for VOA from Beirut.
And in more headline news, Syria's defense minister visited Jordan on Sunday to discuss stability on their mutual border. It's the first such meeting since the Syrian conflict erupted a decade ago. The meeting between Jordan's General Youssef Hunayti and Syrian General Ali Ayyub came nearly 2 weeks after Syrian forces entered the rebel-held district of the southern city of Dara. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jackson Funganyi. Greece has opened a new migrant holding camp to ease long-standing overcrowded conditions that authorities themselves have called a disgrace. The project has humanitarian organization and migration advocates fuming, calling the European Union-funded project an audacious example of Europe's reluctance to effectively address illegal migration, especially in light of a new surge of Afghan migrants anticipated in the aftermath of the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan. Anthi Karasava reports from Athens.
Speaking against the backdrop of the new camp, with its soaring fence and barbed wire, Migration Minister Notis Mitarakis said the facility on the island of Samos would provide asylum seekers a safer, more humane stay.
We're now implementing a new model in the camps, these closed control centers, which provide, on the one hand, much better living conditions, a lot more space for each asylum seeker with all the necessary facilities and the kind of standard of living that you would expect from a European Union country, but at the same time increase security provisions for the benefit of asylum seekers, of the benefit of the staff, and of the benefit of the local communities.
The new facility costs about $50 million, and is largely being funded by the European Union. It will house up to 3,000 people, with the first batch of some 550 refugees scheduled to move in on Monday, moving out from an older camp critics have long decried as among the worst on the continent for being overcrowded and filthy, with little access to bathrooms and hot water. Rimmed with barbed wire fencing, surveillance cameras, X-ray scanners and magnetic doors, and tucked away miles in the rugged highlands of Samos, the new camp, say human rights advocates and aid workers, looks less homey than authorities and the EU are making it out to be. Yorgos Karayannis of Doctors Without Borders, the aid group also known by its French acronym MSF.
For us it's a jail. It's a declaration of harmful policies that are preferred by EU leaders rather than the care, the induction and the ensure of asylum.
Just a couple of miles from the Turkish coast, Samos has been inundated with refugees since more than a million people, mainly Syrians, streamed into Europe in 2015, marking the biggest migration push since the Second World War. Four other Greek islands face similar fates, left to accommodate hundreds of thousands of people to the distress of local communities. Now the centre-right government in Athens says it will make all those camps obsolete, replacing them with new detention centres by the end of next year. In a separate statement, the MSF said the project marked a perfect illustration of how criminal the EU policy is on immigration, preferring, as MSF puts it, to hold and detain people escaping violence, punishing them for wanting to be safe. MSF billed the project a disgrace and warned that it would add to the trauma of displaced people as Europe braces for a fresh migratory push following the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan. Since coming to power, the government of Kyriakos Mitsotakis has taken a hard line on migration. While migratory flows have dropped more than 80% in recent years, largely because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the government in Athens has vowed to block any further illegal entries. Earlier this month, it tripled the size of a soaring wall along its land frontiers with Turkey. It is also considering setting up floating barricades across the Aegean to block rickety rafts from sneaking in with migrants. What is unclear is the position Turkey will take, Greek government officials tell VOA. With tensions brewing anew between the two age-old foes, some officials fear Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan may use the migrant issue to put new pressure on the European Union for more financial aid.
Greece fears that if Erdogan doesn't get what he wants from the EU, he might allow migrants to leave Turkey unimpeded.
Antika Rasava for VOA News, Athens, Greece.
With just a few months before Gambia's December 4th presidential elections, there has been a proliferation of new political parties being registered. The latest among them is the National Unity Party, NUP. The party has been formally launched in the Gambia, with its leader promising to usher in what he called a stable, democratic and prosperous Gambia if elected. As pondering by reports from Raleigh, North Carolina, political parties have been crisscrossing the country to campaign for votes, and one of the party leaders has hailed the military coup in Guinea.
Gambia's former aviation chief, Abdoulaye Ibrahim Adjamé, has jumped into the political race.
I wish to express my profound pleasure for this unusual privilege, which is no less an honor to be appointed as the flag bearer of the National Unity Party. This party is a unique one and has a brand that is unlike any operating conventional political party in the Gambia.
Jame was the Director General of the Gambia Civil Aviation Authority until his recent removal. He has promised to end what he called the politicization of the civil service and government agencies if elected.
We'll reform the civil service into a merit-based and depoliticized cadre of professionals, where we'll assign the right officer to the right job in both the civil service as well as the local government without any political consideration.
Gambians are going to the polls on December 4, 2021. Party leaders have been selling their programs to the voters.
An NUP government will ensure universal health coverage and enhance the focus on primary health care while upgrading secondary and tertiary facilities.
Besides tourism and foreign remittances, agriculture accounts for the greater chunk of Gambia's economy. Jammeh says if elected, he will revamp the agricultural sector.
The Gambia is endowed with a great river, as well as substantial underground water resources. According to the FAO, only 6% of cultivated land in Africa, on average, is irrigated. The Gambia is no exception to this appalling level of agricultural production through irrigation. The NUP will therefore put emphasis on irrigation agriculture to maximize agricultural production and productivity.
The West African country is battling with massive unemployment coupled with economic challenges.
There is a need to promote vocational and skills training centers where pragmatic and skills-based education can be taught.
Meanwhile, the leader of the Gambia Democratic Congress Party, Mama Kande, has held the military coup in Guinea-Conakry.
We are not in support of unconstitutional change of government, but I want to congratulate Colonel Doumbouya for freeing and rescuing the people of Guinea. But my advice to him is for him, if he wants to continue to be a hero, he has to hand over power to civilians.
For VOA News, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
With China's new restrictions on minors playing online games, the global gaming industry wonders what is next. Michelle Quinn reports.
Playing video games for only 3 hours a week. That's the new rule in China for players 17 years old and younger. The global gaming industry is wondering what the long-term impact of these restrictions will be. Lisa Hansen is the founder and CEO of Nico Partners. She spoke to VOA over Zoom.
It's just been someone really yanked back on the reins, and we're waiting to see what happens when the horse starts to go.
For years, the Chinese government has worked to counter the influence of gaming on young people. Now, with the new rules, young gamers can play for 1 hour, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday nights, 8 p.m. to 9 p.m.
So I think the government is saying, we were not kidding. We want our kids to stop playing games all the time.
In China, teenagers recently talked to Agence France-Presse about the new rules. These two high school students only identify themselves as Wang and Wu.
It's like there's a fight between two thoughts in my head. One says, this regulation not allowing me to play games is so annoying. And the other says, you're in your last year of high school. You should be studying. This is a good regulation. I feel conflicted.
Some of my classmates may use their parents' ID to register for the games or buy a game account without restrictions, which isn't too expensive anyways.
Another change, gaming companies, not parents, enforce the rules. Tencent, the Shenzhen-based maker of Honor of Kings and League of Legends, is using facial recognition technology dubbed Midnight Patrol, which reportedly flags players who might be young and playing after curfew. If they don't check in with their face ID, they are blocked from the game. James Steyer, who has long advocated for more education about the effects of gaming, sees an opportunity in the new China gaming rules.
And I think it's the source of very positive, healthy discussion about how to find a healthy media diet, the right balance for your children and teenagers, and quite honestly, for yourself.
And many young players hoping to compete in esports, global competitive online gaming tournaments, won't be able to put in the time to hone their skills, says Warren Hong, 26, a gamer from Oakland, California. He started playing at 11 and got more serious as a teenager traveling to compete.
It's going to be a big hit for a lot of like up-and-coming Chinese gamers. If they really want to play these games, they're only going to get to play one game a day, three games a week. And that's just going to be really tough because you're going to have to compete with people from, you have to compete with people who are playing like 8 hours a day, every single day. And then it's just, it's going to be really hard to keep up with them.
In the short term, Hansen says, the new rules in China might not affect gaming companies' bottom line, but the long-term forecast for the industry will likely change. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production crew, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Be well.